Throughout most of the history of the Western world, and certainly here in the Americas during the past several centuries, the treatment of children has been pretty appalling. Throughout most of this time, the public perception of young people stood somewhere between a pet and a form of cheap farm labor. And popular attitudes regarding young people were certainly on display 100 years ago during the period of industrialization between the end of the 19th and beginning of the 20th century, where young people were forced into some pretty horrid factory conditions. And hone that thought on the word forced for a minute. For some time now, progressives and liberal historians have used, or perhaps I should say misused, this fact from history, this mistreatment of young people in industrial settings, as an example of what they see as runaway free markets, the product of a lack of regulation, a laissez-faire government attitude towards commerce and industry. However, these young people were not forced into these factories by greedy capitalists, but by their parents. The fact that these kids were in these factories has nothing to do with free markets. It has to do with how children were treated by adults one century ago, as slaves. These working conditions, which were truly horrible, and this is not intended in any way as an apology for the industrialists, people like J.P. Morgan and Carnegie and Rockefeller. And that's not because of how they found a way to circumvent the benevolent oversight of the government. It's because of how they ultimately used the government towards their own ends. Hold that thought for a short while. These admittedly horrid working conditions were far superior to the working conditions children were forced into 100 years earlier on the farms, where they worked all day for no pay. This was certainly the case for most children living in the northern states. States with farms, places like western Massachusetts, upstate New York, in the period prior to the Civil War. After the Civil War, when there was no more race-based slavery, this also caught on in the South as well, along with sharecropping and tenant farming. Because involuntary servitude, boy, that just goes hand in hand with tenuous power backed up by some form of mythology. That is just a match made in hell. But that was reality for young people throughout most of history. It was industrialization, these children going into these factories, that made them more visible members of society. For most of the history of the Western world, children were simply invisible, busy being quiet and obedient, honoring thy mother and thy father, like they had learned in church. But throughout the 20th century, attitudes towards children in America began to change dramatically, not really with good intentions. First, it's important to point out that early in the 20th century, more children were made. And I don't say this with respect to an increased birth rate, which is also the case. I mean, more children were made out of people who were previously considered to be adults. This is the idea of adolescence, this period of storm and stress that was introduced in the early 20th century, the first decade of the 20th century. Throughout most of history, the line between childhood and adulthood was far more blurry than it is today, where most of the transition from the child to the adult with respect to responsibility and lifestyle occurred in the mid-teens. But now, with the arrival of this complete arbitrary intellectual invention, adolescence, childhood now extended through the teens. And this extension of childhood through this invention of adolescence, the motivations are somewhat unclear. Robert Epstein, in his book, The Case Against Adolescence, cites a possible cause being an effort to prolong schooling. Certainly plausible. But this group, teenagers, adolescents, young adults, solidified as a focus group in the period of economic expansion after World War II, when marketers and advertisers, people who were probably students of someone like Edward Bernays, the father of public relations, began to identify them as targets for shallow marketing and advertising campaigns that were based on desire, emotion, fear, eventually playing on the need to fit in, to be trendy, to be quote-unquote normal. This all began in the post-war economic expansion. At this point, young people became even more visible members of society, because now you could sell shit to them. Jonathan Taylor Gatto talks about this in his article, Against School, where he wrote, quote, "Mass production required mass consumption, and at the turn of the 20th century, most Americans considered it both unnatural and unwise to buy things they didn't actually need. Mandatory schooling was a godsend on that count. School didn't have to train kids in any direct sense to think they should consume nonstop, because it did something even better. It encouraged them not to think at all. And that left them sitting ducks for another great invention of the modern era, marketing." Now, you needn't have studied marketing to know that there are two groups of people who can always be convinced to consume more than they need to: addicts and children. School has done a pretty good job of turning our children into addicts, but it has also done a spectacular job of turning our children into children. Again, this is no accident. Theorists from Plato to Rousseau to our own Dr. Inglis knew that if children could be cloistered with other children, stripped of responsibility and independence, encouraged to develop only the trivializing emotions of greed, envy, jealousy, and fear, they would grow older, but never truly grow up. Unquote. So there you see another motivation for prolonging childhood and prolonging schooling. And at this point, you can let go of that second thought that I asked you to hold about how these people aren't bad because of how they avoided government, but because of how they used it. Google Rockefeller Education Board if you'd like to learn more. As children grew increasingly visible in society throughout the 1950s and 1960s, perhaps it was no coincidence that this new focus group was able to, for lack of a better phrase, grab onto the coattails of a movement in society towards gender equality and racial and ethnic equality. Attitudes towards children continued to become somewhat more enlightened throughout the 1960s, 1970s, and 1980s. Where now, children had not only become visible, they were no longer like farm slaves or pets. They were almost like actual people. Just younger and more confused and more need of assistance and guidance and management and supervision, according to popular attitudes and perceptions. Some people even began to write books about how to be a good parent. And people bought these books throughout the 1970s and 1980s, my parents included. In the universities, educationists began to explore methods of child-centered learning that actually took into account what children might want to learn. It was arguably never implemented, but it was explored. A lot was changing. People's attitudes were evolving. And gosh, it must have looked so promising to some. But unfortunately, by the time I became an adolescent in the 1990s, this momentum of good intentions, as it always is, was hijacked by the kinds of people who want to use propaganda and magically legitimate forms of aggression to see some goal, personal or political, that they had formulated become a reality. So today we're going to step back to 1994, and I'm going to read an article that was written when I was a junior in high school. Now, this period of time, which I often refer to on the show as 15 years ago, marks not the beginning of the information revolution, but really when it became noticeable to the average person. We started to get on the internet. We started to network and communicate and send emails around 15 years ago. Now, at this time, with respect to how children are viewed and how children are treated by adults in society, we really stood at a crossroads. Because through these new channels of information and communication, young people could finally become visible in a good way, for the right reasons, not because of industrialization or mass media marketing. They would have a forum. They would have a voice. They could express themselves. And today, obviously, we've seen a lot of that. But 15 years ago, I guess people still didn't get it. The information revolution was not quite there yet. So the crossroads was, would people look at the historical mistreatment of children that was now manifesting in society in uncomfortable new ways? And would they go to the root of the problem? Or would they continue the same old bullshit? Because throughout the 1970s and 80s and 90s, young people's visibility increased through the media. So now adults were forced in many ways to look at the condition of teenagers. The depression, the angst, the frustration, which had historically been invisible. It was hidden behind some giant factory machine or corn stalks or in the pews of the church. But now, it was front and center for everyone to see. And usually this abuse of children, this mistreatment of children, would only manifest in adult society in one way. And for centuries, nobody seemed able to make the connection. Young people would get to a point with their angst and frustration where they would go off to some other place and kill other young people that they had never met, gladly, when called upon. Now, governments call this defense. Most of us, of course, would have a slightly more realistic and far less euphemistic way of describing this: war, institutionalized mass murder. And then there are some very astute folks like Lloyd DeMoss, who might describe this phenomenon as the historic, ongoing product and outcome of child abuse. That is a very large topic for another time, but here is a quick comment from DeMoss on that subject.
Motivations just simply are missed in most of academia. Why do we have war? Oh, it must be because nations want to steal from each other, utilitarian purposes. Every single theory that I've ever seen and studied in college of war says that it's called realism. Realism, that means that there's realistic reasons for going and taking something or other from somebody else or subjugating them. Wrong. Just simply historically wrong. I'll give a prize to anyone who shows me a major nation that went to war and got anything out of it. Do you really think that Adolf Hitler declared war against the five biggest countries in the world that were so much more huge and more powerful than him in order to get something? He did it because he was suicidal. The man was suicidal all his life, and Germany was suicidal at that time.
But by the 1990s, something was different. Television news was inundated with these stories of these teenagers who put on different colors and went out and did violence against each other. This was news? Yeah, I guess it's just all a matter of perspective and what's considered socially acceptable. Because in the 1940s, when you could make the case that there really was a problem with teen-on-teen violence, like all over the planet Earth, you never saw like a television news teaser that was something like, "Ooh, tonight at 11, what has gone wrong with America's kids? Thousands of them are flying airplanes over Europe and firebombing innocent civilians. Where did they lose their way and who's to blame? Is it Orson Welles or jazz music? We'll have more. Stay tuned." Because that kind of youth-on-youth violence is totally heroic. When you send the youths to some other country to commit murder or get slaughtered themselves. And, of course, I don't want to make light of a really horrific tragedy in history, what happened to, you know, innocent people in Europe during World War II, but it's also anachronistic because, of course, there wasn't a 24-hour-a-day in-your-face media at that time, and all of the information about that violence was carefully controlled. The state benefited from that violence. So, of course, that's not a crisis. But by the time I became an adolescent, what was, objectively speaking, more of the same now seemed to be, like I said before, some kind of alarming new phenomenon. These young people were killing each other without the appropriate costume on. They were wearing red and blue instead of green. Jesus Christ, what happened to the good old days?
Communities need to realize that the reasons that these kids get involved in these activities typically is that they're looking for identity, recognition, belonging, discipline, love, and respect. And if a community recognizes that, and while the community is doing a couple of different things, we got the police department doing some zero tolerance enforcement and picking up the bad guys, what the rest of the community is going to do is pick up young people that are left behind.
No one can tell the tale of gangs and violence better than the people whose lives have been permanently changed and are personally affected by it every day.
You know, it provides, you know, what the family don't provide, you know. If your mom can't, if you ask your mom for money, you know, and she can't give it to you, you know, you go to the gang, you know. They can give you some drugs, you know, so you can make you some money, you know. And then you don't have to never worry about asking your mom for money again, you know. Or, you know, they can listen to what you have to say. That's most important, you know. If somebody listens to what you have to say, then, you know, you become more in tune with them. You know, if somebody can listen to you.
When I came here, I didn't have daddy anymore, and the gangs were the protection for me, because just like daddy, if a guy touched me in the wrong way and I didn't want to be touched in that way, I could come home and tell daddy. I could go tell my friends and they'd be like, okay, we'll take care of him. There's no problem with that.
I have someone to be there for me emotionally. I have someone just basically just take me up under their arms, you know, give me guidance.
The following article was found on fair.org. It actually comes from their print archives from the March-April 1994 edition. The title is Bashing Youth, Media Myths About Teenagers by Mike Males. Quote, unplanned pregnancies, HIV infection and AIDS, other sexually transmitted diseases, cigarettes, alcohol and drug abuse, eating disorders, violence, suicide, car crashes, unquote. The 21-word lead-in to a Washington Post report from December 22, 1992, sums up today's media image of the teenager. 30 million 12 through 19-year-olds toward whom any sort of moralizing and punishment can be safely directed by liberals and conservatives alike. Today's media portrayals of teens employ the same stereotypes once openly applied to unpopular racial and ethnic groups. Violent, reckless, hyper-sexed, welfare-draining, obnoxious, and ignorant. And like traditional stereotypes, the modern media teenager is a distorted image derived from the dire fictions promoted by official agencies and interest groups. During the 1980s and 1990s, various public and private entrepreneurs realized that the news media will circulate practically anything negative about teens, no matter how spurious. A few examples among many. 1. In 1985, the National Association of Private Psychiatric Hospitals, defending the profitable mass commitment of teenagers to psychiatric treatment on vague diagnoses, invented the fact that a teenager commits suicide every 90 minutes, or 5,000 to 6,000 times every year. Countless media reports of all types, from the Associated Press in April of 1991 to Psychology Today in May of 1992, continue to report this phony figure, nearly three times the true teen suicide toll, which averaged 2,050 per year during the 1980s. 2. In a 1991 campaign to promote school-based clinics, the American Medical Association, AMA, and the National Association of State Boards of Education published a report that inflated the 280,000 annual births to unmarried teenage mothers to 500,000 and claimed a 30-fold increase in adolescent crime since 1950. In fact, 1950 youth crime statistics are too incomplete to compare, and later, more comprehensive national reports show no increase in juvenile crime rates in at least two decades. The facts notwithstanding, the national media dutifully publicized the organization's exaggerations. 3. In the early 1980s, officials hyping the war on drugs orchestrated media hysteria about skyrocketing teenage drug abuse at a time when, in fact, teenage drug death rates were plummeting, down 70% from 1970 to 1982. In the late 80s, the same media outlets parroted official claims of a drug war success, when in reality, youth drug death rates were skyrocketing, up 85% from 1983 to 1991. See, In These Times, May 20th, 1992. This article is very good about citing its sources. There's actually quite a few parenthetical references that I'm leaving out for the purpose of clarity. Today, official and media distortions are one and the same. Who's to blame for poverty? Teenage mothers, declares Health and Human Services Secretary Donna Shalala in uncritical news stories that fail to note that teenage mothers on welfare were poor before they became pregnant. And of course, just let me step out of the article for a minute. These people are incentivized to have children because they get more welfare that way. Back to the article. Who's causing violence? Kids and guns, asserts President Clinton, favorably quoted by reporters who neglect to mention that 6 out of 7 murders are committed by adults. Who's dying from drugs, spreading AIDS, committing suicide? Teenagers, teenagers, teenagers. The media proclaim at the behest of official sources, even though health reports show adults much more at risk from all of these perils than our adolescents. New heading, Media Myth, Teenage Sex. The strange logic of the modern media's attack on adolescence is nowhere stranger than its portrayal of teen sexuality. Consider its jargon. When a child is born to a father over age 20 and a teenage mother, which happened 350,000 times last year, the phenomenon is called children having children. When an adult pays a teenager for sex, it is teenage prostitution. Some 2 million sexually transmitted diseases and 250,000 abortions that result from adult teen sex every year are headlined as teenage VD, AIDS, and abortion. The causes of these epidemic social problems are teenage immaturity, risk-taking, and peer pressure, Their cure is more preaching, programming, and punishment aimed at teenage sex. Of course. According to U.S. Public Health Service reports, 71% of all teenage parents have adult partners over age 20. California and U.S. Vital Statistics reports show that men over age 20 cause 5 times more births among junior high age girls than do boys their own age. Yuck. And 2.5 times more birth among high school girls than high school boys do. Even though many more pregnancies among teenage females are caused by men older than 25 than by boys under 18, media reports and pictures depict only high schoolers. By their choice of terms and images, the media blamed the young and female while giving the adult and male a break. This is exactly the image desired by thousands of agencies and programs who profit politically and financially from the issue, such as Centers for Disease Control, the CDC, which blames teenage AIDS on promiscuous kids playing Russian roulette. That's a quote from the AP. The media have followed the official lead. The three leading news weeklies have all run cover stories featuring the same formulaic reporting. Newsweek's Teens and AIDS, August 3, 1992. Times' Kids, Sex, and Values, May 24, 1993. And U.S. News and World Report's Teenage Sex, Just Say Wait, July 26, 1993, all featured surveys of kids, photos of suburban schools, sidebars lambasting sexy movies, and dire commentary on sexual irresponsibility among schoolboys and girls. Time and U.S. News both blamed teenage sex on confused kids and held up sex and abstinence education as the cure. Imagine how different these stories would be if the media told the decidedly unsexy truth about pregnant teens. The large majority are impoverished girls with histories of physical, sexual, and other abuses by parents and other adults, and most are impregnated by adult men. When the LA Times, in an exceptional report from May in 1993, actually showed the bleak childhoods of pregnant, disadvantaged teens, the accompanying official rhetoric blaming MTV and peer pressure looked silly. Another new heading, Media Myth, Teenage Violence. On teenage violence, the media picture is similarly skewed. Teen violence, Wild in the Streets, from Newsweek in August of 1993, Kids and Guns, Newsweek, from March of 1992, When Killers Come to Class, U.S. News, November 1993, and Big Shots, Time, August 1993, all follow a standard format. The lead-in details the latest youth mayhem, followed by selected, quote, facts on the causes of skyrocketing teen violence, adolescent depravity, gun-toting metalheads, TV images, rap attitude, gang culture, lenient youth court judges. And perhaps, in a few well-buried sentences, such small matters as poverty, abuse, racial injustice, unemployment, and substandard schools. Given the emphasis on teen violence, a California Department of Justice report from August of 1993 comes as a shock. It found that 83% of murdered children, half of murdered teenagers, and 85% of murdered adults are slain by adults over the age of 20, not by kids, or in President Clinton's shock phrase, quote, 13-year-olds with automatic weapons, unquote. In fact, FBI reports show 47-year-olds, people Clinton's age, are twice as likely to commit murder than 13-year-olds. But while the media champion official rhetoric on violence by youth, they rarely provide similar attention to the epidemic of adult violence against youth. The National Center on Child Abuse and Neglect from May 1993 reported that at least 350,000 children and teenagers are confirmed victims of sexual and other violent abuses every year by adults whose average age is 32 years. Comparison of these figures with crime reports shows that for every violent and sexual offense committed by a youth under 18, There are three such crimes committed by adults against children and teens. The reporting of the 1992 National Women's Study of 4,000 adult women is a case study in media bias. The Rape in America report found that 12 million American women have been raped. Of these, 62% were raped before age 18. 500,000-plus children and teenagers victimized every year averaged 10 years of age. Their rapist's average age was 27. The media unrelentingly headline children having children and killer kids and endlessly wonder what is, quote, out of control when it comes to the way that many teens think, unquote, quoted from U.S. News and World Report in July of 1993. Surely the widespread adult violent and sexual attacks against youths are a compelling answer. Consistent research shows such abuses are the key factors in violence, pregnancy, drug abuse, and suicide among teenagers. See Family Planning Perspectives, January 2, 1992. Similarly, the media have largely ignored the rising number of prison studies, including those at the Minnesota State Prison and the Massachusetts Treatment Center for Sexually Dangerous Persons, which show 60% to 90% of all inmates, and nearly all of those on death row, were abused as children. The most conservative study by the National Institute of Justice projects that 40% of all violent crimes, some 500,000 every year, result from offenders being abused as children. In a similar vein, news outlets have generally failed to examine the enormous increase in youth and young family poverty, which rose by 50% from 1973 to 1991. Thanks, Great Society. That's from the U.S. Census Bureau Poverty in the United States study. Nor have mainstream media seriously addressed the devastating effects of racism, rising poverty, and unemployment on a generation of young people of color. The media portrait reflects politicians' unadmitted priorities, condemning violence by youth as a guaranteed crowd pleaser. Focusing on adult violence against kids isn't as popular. Most news consumers are adults, and kids can't vote. In a rare exception, a report that devoted more space to poverty and child abuse than to TV sex, Time's October 8, 1990 cover article, pointed out a truth long known to prison wardens and juvenile court judges. Quote, if children are not protected from their abusers, then the public will one day have to be protected from the children. Unquote. But most outlets continue to treat violent youth as mysterious freaks of nature. The lead headline in the Sunday Los Angeles Times from December 9, 1993 opinion section blared, quote, who are our children? One day they are innocent, the next they may try to blow your head off, unquote. Perhaps the LA Times, whose landmark August 25, 1985 survey indicated that childhood sexual abuse is epidemic, affecting one-fifth of all Americans, should instead question its own media escapism. From July through September 1993, that newspaper carried 34 articles and commentaries on the effects of violent media, rap, and video games on youth, but not one inch on the effects of child abuse in promoting youth violence. Since this is more than 15 years ago, it's important to point out that inches was a term to define the amount of coverage space in a newspaper. Oh, and people used to get news on these big sheets of paper. You could buy them at convenience stores. They might still have them. While the LA Times gives prominent coverage to charges of child abuse involving the rich and famous, like singer Michael Jackson, and the Beverly Hills Menendez brothers, when the LA Council on Child Abuse and Neglect reported 140,000 children abused in the county in 1992, the Times relegated the story to an inside section with no follow-up or comment. New heading. Two sides, same bias. The extraordinary lack of context and fairness in media coverage of youth stems from two elemental difficulties. First, the standard media assumption is that fairness is served by quoting both sides. But on youth issues, both sides frequently harbor adult biases against teenagers. In the much-publicized debates over school programs to reduce teen pregnancy, for example, the press quoted liberal sources favoring condom handouts, balanced by conservative sources demanding abstinence education. However, both lobbies based their arguments on the same myth, that heedless high school boys are the main cause of teen pregnancy, and avoided the same disturbing fact, that even if every high school boy abstained from sex or used condoms, most teen pregnancies would still occur. The second difficulty is that teenage behavior is not separate from adult behavior. Such hot topics as teenage pregnancy, teen suicide, and youth violence are artificial political and media inventions. In real-world environments, teenagers usually act like the adults of their family, gender, race, class, location, and era, often because their behaviors occur with adults. For example, vital statistics of the United States shows that white adults are twice as likely to commit suicide as black adults, and white teens are twice as likely to commit suicide as black teens. From 1940 to 1990, unwed birth rates rose 4.7 times among teenage women and 4.6 times among adult women. The FBI's 1992 Uniform Crime Report show that men commit 88% of all adult violent crime and boys commit 88% of all juvenile violent crime. Why are adult context, common to media reports on youth prior to the 1970s, only rarely cited today? Because that would prevent adolescents from serving as the latest scapegoats for problems that affect society in general. And there is a subtler reason. The interests circulating negative images of teens want the source of malaise located within youth, where it can be treated by whatever solutions the publicizing interest groups profit from, rather than in unhealthy environments whose upgrading will require billions of dollars in public spending. Thus, short-term political and corporate profit lies not in fixing environments, but in fixing kids. The treatment industry's message is clear. Quote, "Our teenagers have lost their way," unquote, declares the AMA. The press has been a key element in the campaign to persuade the public that the cause of youth pregnancy, violence, suicide, and drug addiction lies within the irrational psychologies and vulnerabilities of adolescents. A standard news and documentary feature is The Troubled Teen, rescued by the teamwork of loving parents and get-tough professionals. Despite melodramatic media splashes advertising the success of this program or that therapy, often based on testimonials or the promoter's own study, controlled long-term research finds efforts to cure troubled teenagers generally ineffective. On the other hand, the publicity campaigns for such treatments disguised as news have been quite successful. During the 1980s, the number of teens forced into intensive psychiatric treatment quadrupled, while adolescent commitments to drug and alcohol treatment tripled. If institution and treatment industry claims are valid, we should have seen dramatic improvements in youth behavior. Exactly the opposite is the case. In the last 5 to 10 years, intense media and government attacks on various behaviors, chiefly drug abuse, violence, and pregnancy, have been followed by rapidly rising problems among teenagers. Stable violence rates and rapidly declining birth rates and drug death levels prior to 1985 have suddenly reversed. All three rose rapidly from the mid-1980s to the early 1990s. The media's unwillingness to question official policy and its failures helped make these reverses possible. A few journalists refuse to kowtow to official myths and instead publicize the enormous racial imbalances inherent in youth violence, the fundamental sexism of the current debate over teen pregnancy, the realities of millions of raped, beaten, and neglected children, the skyrocketing rates of youth poverty imposed by ever-richer American elites, and the futility of modern behavior modifications, laws, and treatments aimed at forcing the young to adjust to intolerable conditions. Ron Harris's Los Angeles Times series on juvenile crime, which ran in August of 1993, analyzed the crucial factors of racism, poverty, and abuse in creating today's youth violence, and exploded the popular fiction of lenient sentencing. Teens, in fact, serve prison terms 60% longer than adults for equivalent crimes. Kevin Fedarko's perceptive eulogy from Time, January 1992, to post-industrial Camden, New Jersey, quote, a city of children relinquished to poverty and prostitution, may stand as the decade's finest illustration of 1990s America's abandonment of its young. Jay Talon's expose from Newsday, January 7, 1988, of the profiteering behind the skyrocketing rate of fraudulent adolescent psychiatric commitments to fill empty beds in overbuilt hospitals was one of the few to question official treatment claims. Time's indictment of the shameful selfishness, abuses, and uncaring attitudes of adults towards America's most disadvantaged minority, its children, also stands as an indictment of today's media obsequiousness. These articles' debunking of conventional wisdom does not stop the same children-blaming myths from showing up in day-to-day coverage of youth problems. But these occasional exceptions do suggest how media responsibility could halt today's political assault on youth and heal spreading intergenerational hostilities. The end, and unfortunately that hopeful speculation in the last sentence of this article never became reality. So that's where we were one generation ago. Teenagers, many of whom were dealing with the same real-life physical, sexual, and emotional abuse that had been inflicted upon children for centuries, if not millennia, that meme that has just continued through seemingly all of history. Well, along with that abuse, that neglect, that mistreatment, a pile-on began. First came the media, basically being fueled by interest groups and propagandists, blaming youth, villainizing youth. What followed, and was certainly accelerated by events like Columbine, crackdown, that put into practice with respect to both the schools and to law enforcement, codifying all of these negative attitudes
and subsequent disrespectful practices
towards adolescents that had been swirling around in the media throughout the 80s and 90s.
And infecting human civilization as far as you want to go back. In other words, in the 1990s, teenagers like me were hit hard by a perfect storm of institutionalized abuse, aggression, propaganda, manipulation, and confusion.
Well, that generation has grown today. We're adults. Back then, we learned that we were not to be trusted. We were not self-sufficient. We could not be independent. We needed to defer to authorities, to rulers, to masters. For our very safety and survival, because we were incompetent and dangerous.
And we took all these lessons, and we internalized all of these messages as a generation. And then we became your parents, and your teachers, and your school resource officers, etc. See how that all works? And This was not a new phenomenon from my generation to yours. So, to the young people of today, as far as society and adulthood and responsibility and leadership is concerned, you're up next. What are you going to do? While sinners in the children play.